While I was in Alabama, Elder Gus Harder was in the meeting, and I heard him preach one message which stirred my mind significantly on a subject. He began the discourse this way. He said, "Have you ever awakened in the middle of the night and you lifted your hand to your face and you literally could not see your hand in front of your face because it was so dark? And you got up out of the bed and you started walking across the floor and tripped across the shoes that you had carelessly left there beside the bed. In your frustration, you stumbled into a half-open door, stumped your toe, and screamed out in the darkness of the night, 'Somebody, turn on the light!'" Most of us have been there. He went on to say that in the nation in which we live, people are tripping over all sorts of sinful action. Our nation is committing over 1 million abortions a year, legally slaughtering babies every year. Over 30 million have been legally murdered since 1973. Our nation allows homosexuality in many of our cities. It is literally a legal proceeding for men to marry men and women to marry women. That's the nation in which you and I live. I love it, but I don't love that. We're wandering in a darkness, a fog. We're wandering in error. So many people today are looking at themselves rather than looking at God, perhaps having a form of godliness but denying the power of God, claiming they believe in God yet failing to follow Him and His principles. Wandering around in the darkness, we see 45 million people a year who are treated for clinical depression. 45 million. What causes it? Wandering around in the dark. Have you ever wanted to say, "Somebody, please turn on the light"? In Psalm 119, in the 109th verse, it says, "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." Here the psalmist David tells us that there is a light in our world. We're wandering around in darkness. We labor in darkness. We fall in darkness. We make mistakes in darkness. We suffer in darkness. And we begin to scream for light. And so often we run from the light rather than running unto the light. God's Word is the light. "Thy Word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my path." I used to not understand the difference between a lamp and a light. Whenever I finally began to spend some time in the caves down at Greenville a few years ago, I began to realize the need for both a lamp and a light. A lamp for your feet. Why? In the caves, just about every step you take could be a potential dangerous step. Just about every time you take a step, you've got to watch to make sure your foot doesn't go in a hole or doesn't step on an unstable rock and you turn your ankle. You've got to be very cautious. And so therefore, you need a light shining right where your next foot or your next step is going to be taken. But not only do you need to see what your next step is going to be right at the end of your toes, but you need to see what's out there in the distance. Looking ahead, trying to determine, do I go right or do I go left? Or have I gone the wrong way altogether? You see, the necessity of having a light out there in the distance, as well as a light right at our feet. "Thy word," says the psalmist, "is a light to my path and a lamp to my feet." I implore you to pick up this book and spend time in it. If you're frustrated, which many people are, because you really don't know where to start, or you really don't know how to begin a Bible study program in your own personal life, then I'd like to talk to you after the service. I think I've got some practical suggestions that would be of great benefit to you that doesn't take up much of your day, and yet it will do nothing but help you. God's Word is the light. Well, I want us this morning to go back to the day that the light went out. You may be already thinking, well, if we're in darkness, how did we get in such a condition? If our world is in such darkness, how did it happen? Why are we in the darkness that we're in? Let's go back to the day when the light went out. And I'd like to read to you from Genesis chapter 3. We'll begin reading in verse 1, Genesis chapter 3 and the first verse. "Now the serpent," I don't like those things, "Now the serpent was more subtle than all the beasts of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman," the serpent said to the woman, "Yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, Ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, Ye shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. Ye shall be as gods. Adam, rather Eve, may have mistaken the statement by the serpent. She may have thought he said, Ye shall be as God. Capital G-O-D. He didn't. He said, Ye shall be as gods. Little g. Big difference. There's a lot of difference between a capital G and a little g. Capital G, God of heaven and earth, the God that controls all things according to the counsel of His own will. The little g, the God that has no power, no ability. He's dead. Has no life about Him. Well, the serpent said to Eve, Ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil, experiencing good and evil. She probably thought he meant, You'll be like God. And if you want to play with evil, you can play with it because you'll be God. If you want to play with good, you can play with it because you'll be God. You will have the ultimate choice to do whatever you want. That's what Eve thought the serpent was saying, and that's probably what the serpent wanted her to think. Eve, I can just imagine, said, All right, I'll think about it. She thought about it about 30 seconds, looked around, saw the tree, saw that the fruit was good to eat, and picked it, and gave to her husband, and he did eat. And darkness came. The light went out. Why? Because God explained that in the day that they ate of that tree, they would die. There were no second statements to be made. There was no follow-up to come. God simply said, If you eat, you'll die. I would say to parents, one of the best ways to set guidelines for your children is for them to know what the rules are and what the punishment will be if the rule is broken. You say, Well, now I don't like to tell my kid about how he's going to be punished. God told His kid how he was going to be punished. See, God is the perfect parent. God created man and God created woman, and He told them, In the day you eat thereof. Here's the rule, don't eat of that particular tree. But if you do, here's your punishment, you'll die. Think about that just as a practical suggestion. That's not my subject today by any means. The serpent said, Ye shall be as gods. I believe the devil has been telling people that ever since. What he's really saying, and what we really like to think is, you will be in control of your own destiny. Now, we as human beings like to think that, don't we? We like to think that we're in control. We would like to think that we could get up in the morning and establish our schedule for the day and meet it to the letter. But how many of us make it? I write a schedule out virtually every day. I even put down time, you know, from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock, I'll do this. 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, I'll do this. But I'll tell you what, by the end of that day, that thing's got so many red marks all over it. It's gotten changed, altered, obliterated half the time. We'd like to think we're in control, but experience teaches that we're not. You know, just about the time we think we've got everything pretty well under control, something begins to go awry. I don't know how many people I've met who've told me at 61 years of age they just can't wait till next year when they can retire. And they have been so excited, they've got everything in their mind, they're finally at last going to be in control of their life. Now they won't have to answer to an employer. Now they're old enough they don't have to answer to everybody that comes down the pike like younger people seem like they have to. Whenever you finally get to 62 years of age and can finally retire, say, I've got it made now. Well, friends, I hate to tell you, but by the time you get 62 years of age, you can expect some things are going to start failing along the line. Somewhere, something's going to start happening. I remember a professor I had in college who came in the office where I was working one day. He was hobbling on crutches and had been for the past 6 months or so. It seemed like it was forever. And he was a very distinguished man, and the type of man that was so proud that the thought of carrying crutches with him was just the very worst tragedy that could happen. And he walked through those doors and threw those crutches down and sat down in the chair, and he said, I cannot wait to get out of this place and retire. He said, and I tell you one more thing. He said, I'll be absolutely furious if my health breaks. I thought, boy, you don't have any control over that. You're probably bringing on a heart attack by being so upset about it. We like to think we're in control, but we're not. Break the news to you, we're not. Now, there are certain things that we can, in some measure, control. A good number of you made a choice today. Well, let me back up. Every one of us made a choice today. If I'll back up just a little bit. We all made a choice to get out of bed. And some of you younger people are saying this morning, I didn't make that choice. It was made for me. Well, you know, in a sense, you're right. But in a sense, you still had to make the choice to get out of bed. You say, well, they made me. Well, what they're telling you is, I'll make you wish you had if you don't, you know. So everybody here, some way or another, has already made a choice today. A choice to obey and get out of bed. So to some extent, you were in control of that. Several of you then have made a voluntary choice to get in your automobile and come to church and be here today. You've made a choice. To some extent, you're in control. There are an awful lot of things we're not in control of. I'd like to think that I could get in this pulpit this morning and promise you before I started that I would preach the gospel of the Son of God. I'd like to be able to promise you that I would have the best liberty that I've had in 6 years at this church today. I'd like to be able to tell you that, but I don't know because I'm not in control of that. I'd like to be able to get up here and tell you that we're going to have 5 people join this church after the service is over today because I'd like to be that much in control. But I'm not. The devil promised Eve she would be in control. Well, did she gain control? Nope. See, the devil lies to us. He presents to us the most beautiful things. Makes us think that we're going to get something that we don't get. He gives us just enough of it, though, to make us want more. Now, you look around you today and see if you don't see some power-hungry people. Now, all of us like some power somewhere. All of us would like to influence somebody. We sure would. You say, well, I don't want to influence anybody. I don't want to have any power over anybody. I don't want to impress anybody. Everybody's scale of who they want to impress is different. You know, you may want to impress the entire world. You may want to be in front of television cameras and make speeches that would literally rock the world back on its heels. But others of you are saying, goodness, I'd be scared to death in a situation like that. I don't want to do that. But if you keep bringing the situation along, you'll finally realize there's somebody somewhere you want to impress. You know, old Baptists are just the same as everybody else. We've given away and sold more of those papers that's got Governor Hunt's picture in it than I ever saw in my life. We're as human as anybody else. We like to let people know about that thing. Especially since Primitive Baptists have been accused of being so illiterate and so behind the times and backwoodsy and all that. We go overboard sometimes when we find somebody who is in the public eye. And by the way, just because we don't have a doctor in our congregation doesn't mean there aren't a pile of doctors that are old Baptists around this country. I've run into a lot of them. And there are more and more of them all the time. You know, I don't know why we think we have to defend ourselves against that accusation when it's so false to begin with. But anyway, we're just as human as anybody else. We like to think we're in control. We would like to impress somebody. Ye shall be as gods. And then he goes on and says, knowing good and evil. That didn't just mean you're going to know about them, but you're going to experience good and evil. Now, one of the problems with knowing about good and evil and experiencing good and evil is it's difficult to tell the difference. Say what? Yes, it's difficult to tell the difference. Sometimes you don't know whether this is good or whether this is bad. I've talked to multitudes of people in recent days who have been taken in by some of the philosophies of this world. I preached yesterday morning on a subject in Alabama, and a lady came to me immediately following the service and agreed with everything I said, and then started telling me all this stuff she'd been reading, which was directly opposed to what I was preaching. I couldn't believe it. Somebody who came up and said, I love what you preached. I thought it was just right. It was what I needed to hear. I needed that. And then started spilling out all this garbage that directly contradicted everything I said. You see, there are God's people, sincere, God-loving, Christ-honoring people who are being taken in by the lies of the devil. It's difficult to know what's good and what's evil. God gave us 10 commandments in Exodus chapter 20 and again in Deuteronomy chapter 5, I believe. We find there those commandments. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God. Have no other gods before me, you know. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Those are all pretty simple. Thou shalt not steal. Those are not all that hard to keep. They're pretty plain, pretty straightforward. Boy, when it comes down to some of the modern teaching that leads you to break a commandment of God without you even knowing it, We're living in a dark, dark time. I want to get more specific if the Lord directs my mind in that way before I close. So if you're just wondering what in the world I'm talking about, just hold on. We'll get there. Satan promised Eve, you'll be like a god. You'll know good and evil. You'll experience good and evil. I want to go back about 160 years ago in the history of the Baptist Church and find that Satan was telling this lie even 160 years ago to the Baptist people. Whenever the Baptist Church first came to this country, there were no Primitive Baptists, Missionary Baptists, Landmark Baptists, Regular Baptists, Missionary Baptists, Free Will Baptists. I could go on and on. American Baptists. There were none of these varieties of the Baptist family. You were either a Baptist or you weren't. You were a Baptist. Maybe you were a Methodist. Maybe you were a Presbyterian. But there weren't 100 varieties of the Baptist family. So in this country, God blessed, under the preaching of sovereign grace, what we preach today. The Baptist churches were established and planted all over this country and flourished greatly. A little church down in North Carolina started out with 6 members and 2 years later had 600 members. Preaching just what we preach today. They didn't have any organizations. They didn't have any special singing. They just had what we have today, directed by the Spirit of God. Grew by leaps and bounds. But in 1832, in this part of the country, around 1840, there came a division. Because there were some people who began to preach the theory that man could do something about his eternal destiny. Now, boy, that flatters the flesh. Just imagine this setting, if you will. Some of you will be shocked to even think that there are people who do this. Others of you will probably be familiar with it. Just imagine I come down out of the pulpit at the close of today's service and I say this. Now, sinner friend, God loves you. Jesus Christ died for you. The Holy Spirit is calling you. But the choice for your eternal salvation is yours. Now, what if I said that? Say, okay, God did His part. Jesus did His part. The Spirit did His part. And look who it's left up to. God? Nope. Me. Now, can you immediately point to that and see that there's something inherently wrong? That is, that God is reduced to the level of man. Others represent it this way. They'll say, God voted for you before the world began. The devil also voted for you. And there's a tie vote, and you have got to break the tie with your decision. How frustrating. How distressing to think that there are literally people who believe that the devil has as much power as God, and that you have more power than both of them. See, that kind of doctrine just doesn't fit with God's Word. What happened? Somebody began to preach, you shall be as gods. You can make the decision. It's all up to you, sinner. Is it up to the sinner? Saul of Tarsus was on a road one day. Man, he was a sinner, wasn't he? I'll tell you what, he was such a sinner that he had stood and watched and given consent as Stephen, the servant of God, had been stoned to death. Imagine, preaching the gospel. And while you're still preaching, you see stones whirling through the air. And you know those stones aren't being thrown at a target, they're being thrown at you. And the next thing you know, you're dying. Well, Saul stood there and watched that and consented unto it. Well, a few days later, he was on the road to Damascus with letters of authority to stone some other people, to put some other people in prison who were preaching the same gospel. And along that way, God arrested him and brought him down. Saul did not make a decision. God made a decision. You see, there's this theory then in the world that has taken churches by storm that you have to make the decision instead of God making the decision. What is that but simply saying, ye shall be as gods? One text, one only, will prove that theory entirely wrong. Romans chapter 9, verse 16. So then, it. What's the it? Election. Election unto salvation. If you want to expand it, we'll say salvation. So then salvation is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. You still believe the sinner's got a choice? He says it's not of the sinner that wills. The sinner says, all right, I believe, I'll believe. It's not of him that willeth. The sinner says, all right, I believe, I'll get baptized. It's not of him that runneth, acteth, act of the body. It's not an act of the mind, not an act of the body, but of God that showeth mercy. Ye shall be as gods? Don't think so. We'll be servants of God, but not gods ourselves. Now, that was 160 years ago that theory came into prominence. It's still with us today. You can listen to some of the prominent preachers today, Charles Stanley, Billy Graham, others on the television or radio, who preach this same theory, still preaching the same doctrine after all those years. I'm thankful to say that there's been more of an emphasis upon grace in the last 5 years than I've heard in all my life, and many preachers who are much older than me say likewise. But nonetheless, there's this theory that's very, very popular in the world, and the reason it's so popular, I say this with, as Brother Sonny Pyle says, all the kindness that my old gruff voice will allow, I say this with kindness, but there is the reason that theory is so popular is that it elevates man. It makes you feel good. Why, God has given you all that attention. Jesus Christ has given you all that attention. The Spirit has given you all that attention. This church is giving you all that attention. And now it's left up to you. All eyes are on you. Wow. Every little child, just about without exception, likes to have attention. And that's the little child in us. Boy, I sure do like to have attention. God kind of brings us down to our place when He says, you know, it's not when you will it. It's not when you run. But it's whenever I, in my mercy, sovereignly choose you and save you by my grace. That's wonderful. Doesn't give man any place to glory. Gives all the glory unto God. That's not my subject today, because I want to show you and try to relate to you in the remaining part of this message today that there are some things in this world that are far more dangerous than that theory. You see, 160 years ago, that was the chief thing that was facing the church. And I mean, every old Baptist preacher undoubtedly preached about it. And, you know, 160 years later, I still don't feel like I've preached unless I've nailed an Arminian tie to the wall. You know, I still feel like I've got to try to just take a lick or two at this idea and try to tear it apart and let people realize that salvation's not by works, it's by grace. But how many times have we preached such a message and taught the people and retaught the people and retaught the reteaching to the extent that we've forgotten about some other things that are more dangerous than that theory? See, that's in churches in our world. But churches aren't really all that influential. You know what's more influential than a church on any day? A school? Or a college? Or a home? With a good, bright, beautiful television set? More influential than churches any day. I don't care what the church has got in it. I don't care if it's got the best programs in the world, greatest teaching on morality from the pulpit, the best singers that bring forth good godly messages from songs. You know what's more powerful? Hollywood. You know what's having more influence in our world today? Secular teaching. Worldly ideas. They sure are. You say, well, I'm not worried about that. We live here in a little rural part of the country. Here where we're sheltered, we don't ever have to worry about all that. Yeah, I once thought that myself. I once thought that. Well, we don't have to worry about that anymore. We're out here in the country. They've got it in New York, and they've got it in Atlanta. They've got it in San Francisco, but we don't have it in Greenville. Do you know we had it in Greenville? You know you've got it in Roncevert? Sure do. You sure do. There is no place in our country. There may be a few, but I'm going to just exaggerate slightly. There's no place in our country that has not been influenced by the liberal thinking of our media, especially the television media. You say, well, I know that. Why are you taking up our precious time on Easter Sunday morning to tell us that? Because I want you to know that Satan is still telling people today, ye shall be as gods. What is the idea that's so common today? I mentioned it briefly on the third Sunday. It's what I like to call me-ism. What? Me-ism. In Isaiah chapter 14, we find the story of Lucifer, who says, I will ascend. I ought to read that. It's so good. I mean, it's really not. It's awful. But it makes the point. If I can find it here. Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12. I'm not going to try to interpret this passage for you. That's another message, and hopefully I'll have a little more light on it in the future. But I want you to listen for one word. It's a little word, so listen close. It says, how art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Who said it? Oh, Lucifer. Lucifer said, you know, I want to be like God. Isn't that what the devil promised Eve back in the Garden of Eden so many years ago in our history? Why, it sure was. You'll be like God. Nowadays, people are coming along and saying, just like Lucifer said, you know, you can be like God. They don't come out and say, you can be a little God. Well, some of them do. Any of you ever heard of Shirley MacLaine? Shirley MacLaine, prominent New Ager. I don't know all about her. Shirley MacLaine stood on a beach a while back, screamed with upraised hands at the heavens and said, I am God! Said it twice. I can just imagine the eternal God of heaven sitting up there looking down. And from his vantage point, I can imagine that Shirley MacLaine didn't look much bigger than the grains of sand on that shore, you know? And yet screaming to the top of her lungs that she is God. The little children here today know better than that. Most of these children know that there's a God that's... You're not God, but you know you need God, don't you? Ye shall be as gods. Me-ism. You ever heard of the human potential movement? That's all over us today. You may not have heard it by that name. You may have looked in the bookstore, and you may... I remember one time being in a bookstore, and I looked at the cover of this Bible, and I thought it said the Positive Thinker's Bible. I thought, well, I'm a positive thinker. I ought to look at that Bible. Picked it up and realized it didn't say positive thinkers. It said possibility thinkers. Well, I didn't know what in the world was he talking about. Possibility thinker, you know. Well, everybody thinks of possibilities all the time, I suppose. Man, was I ignorant. I started reading about the Possibility Thinker's Bible. Found out that is an entire movement that focuses on self rather than on God. What does it do? It simply says that by doing certain things that we as creatures unlock a tremendous potential that's all around us. And what man can conceive, he can achieve. How do you believe that? Ye shall be as God, said the serpent. What says our leaders today, even religious leaders? Ye shall be as gods. Either you can choose to get your home assigned in heaven, or you can choose your destiny here below. Whatever you can achieve or conceive in your mind, you can achieve simply by putting your hand to it. I told you last time that if I put my mind to it, I could do it for an hour, I could do it for a day, I could do it for a week. Put my mind to flying out of this room, you know I'd never get off the ground. There are certain things that no matter how hard you believe it, no matter how much you conceive it, no matter how much you think about it, it's not going to happen. There are some possibilities that just aren't possibilities. Ye shall be as gods, said the serpent. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11, there was another example where some people wanted to be like God. They wanted to be able to reach their full potential. You know, they believe that God Himself probably evolved into who He was, and so they believe, well, we can do that as well. We'll evolve into God. We'll make ourselves a name. Genesis chapter 11 is the story of the Tower of Babel. Most of you are familiar with it. It says in verse 1, the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. How exciting. Kids, you wouldn't have to study Spanish. You'd never have to study French in high school. You wouldn't have to worry about all that. The whole world was of one language. Came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Pause. So we're going to build us a tower. Now I suspect they had several things in mind in building this tower. It's one of the reasons I don't like church steeples. It reminds me of the Tower of Babel. We're going to build this tower that reaches into heaven. Why did they want a tower to reach into heaven? Because they were symbolizing by that. In fact, it was more than symbolism. It was quite literal. They believed that they could get to heaven by the works of their hands. Build us a tower that will reach where? Right into heaven itself. Pitiful how people walk in darkness, isn't it? They believed that by building a tower tall enough, they could finally reach heaven. Did they make it? No. They started building the tower. They're going to reach all the way to heaven. I mean, they've got the drive. They've got the enthusiasm. They've got the conception in their mind. They're believing in it. They're doing everything they possibly can to cause it to come to pass, but did they make it? Notice their motivation. And let us make a name. A what? A name. Me-ism. Focus on me. Let us make ourselves a name. Oh, we're all afflicted with that disease. You know, it used to be pretty well understood that pride was the chief besetting sin of the human race. We all had too much pride, and we needed to do everything we could to get rid of our high ego. That used to be pretty well assumed, and people made that effort. Lived down to earth. Never did try to put on airs. Didn't think about themselves better than they did their neighbors. What do we see today? Just the direct opposite. You don't have enough pride, people say. You don't have enough of a good view of yourself. Put yourself up, and then you'll be able to look at everybody else all right. That's not what the book says. The book says put yourself down, and God will lift you up. The book says put yourself down, and God will lift you up, and also give you a good view of everybody else. It's amazing how different the world looks at things. He says, we're going to make ourselves a name. We want to be prominent. We want to be noticed. You know, you don't have to teach a child to do that.